Hi, kids. Welcome to Bronco Land. We got some smart ones in the room.
Welcome back to the DenverBroncos.com podcast. Thanks for joining us. Vikings week, we come off two road games in a row here, and we have a little bit of a short stint back at home. And, 3-0, undefeated, all the games without a starting defensive end, Derek Wolfe being out. And one more game, he'll be able to come back. And frankly, they really need it because they're really banged up at this point.
Yeah, and on the defensive line in particular, Vance Walker was limited in practice on Thursday because of an elbow problem. Now, I expect that he's going to be able to play Sunday against Minnesota, but at the same time, it just lets you know that's another area of the team that's battling injuries or in the case of Derek Wolfe, suspensions. Look at the offensive line in practice this week. Tyson Brilo didn't practice Wednesday or Thursday. Evan Mathis didn't practice Thursday. Lou Vasquez didn't practice Wednesday, although that was a veteran's rest day. Elsewhere in the blocking scheme, James Casey, who was inactive against Detroit, he didn't practice on Thursday because his knee swelled up on him before practice. Owen Daniels got a veteran's rest day on Thursday. The team's banged up. And here we are. We're only 3 weeks into the season. It's banged up. So yeah, it's cause for concern. But a lot of teams are dealing with injuries, and you just have to press on through. Simbrilo's injury clearly is a part of the reason why Tyler Palumbus is now Bronco again. Started for 8 games in the 2009 season. Played in 08 as well. Waived during preseason of 2010, bounced around, has played his entire career in zone blocking-based scheme, so he's a good fit for what the Broncos do. And, of course, his offensive line coach back in 2008 and 2009 was Rick Dennison, who's now the Broncos offensive coordinator. So there's good knowledge of what Palumbus can do, but still, it's a group that's hurting. And really, the Broncos are a little bit fortunate that Palumbus was on the market this week. He was only available because the Falcons had to promote tight end Mickey Schuer Jr. from the practice squad to the 53 because Jacob Tammy's going to miss some time with a concussion down there, and that's why Palumbus was let go.
The Falcons only had 2 tight ends in that Dallas game I was watching, and then Jacob went out, and so they were down to 1, and you're thinking, well, if they don't have one, if you have one left, then
it's kind of similar situation to running backs with the Broncos, although the Broncos have 3 instead of 2, but if the injuries to C.J. Anderson and Juwan Thompson had been more serious in Detroit, you probably would have been looking at a scenario where Capri Bibbs had to be bumped up from the practice squad. But
yeah.
Anderson and Thompson have been full go this week. Juwan told me in the locker room Wednesday that his neck was fine. He said it was a precautionary thing, nothing to worry about. I'm good to go. So we'll see. And Rick Dennison said Thursday after practice that that C.J. Anderson, has been cleared, that he hasn't heard anything from team trainer Steve Greek Antonopoulos that he wouldn't be able to go. So we'll see, even though Anderson clearly has been struggling coming off that toe injury he had in week 1.
In regards to the running game, going back to the Detroit game, the offense used a lot of the pistol formation, shotgun with the running back behind, and passing offense didn't look too dissimilar from what we had seen do well in the Kansas City game and last year with Peyton in the shotgun. He had more time. The protection was better. Running game still a bit slow to get going. They didn't produce well. I think it was 41 yards on 22 carries. I know you've gone back and looked at the tape. Can you tell progress even when they don't produce?
You can see progress when it's there. Unfortunately, I didn't see as much of it as I wanted to in the ground game. Obviously, the passing game got back up to speed. And clearly, that's a result of Peyton Manning working more in the shotgun and the pistol. It won't be something you see exclusively, obviously. And I don't think you're going to have a game where 58 of 62 snaps are in shotgun or pistol. I think they may try to move away from that just a little bit, but still, I think you're going to see plenty of pistol going forward because it's a nice compromise formation that allows the running back to line up behind the quarterback, but also see the field. I think the key thing for Peyton Manning is when he's in the shotgun or the pistol, he can start his reads quicker because he's not dropping back. So that basically takes a half that kind of takes a half second, a three quarter of a second off the time that in which he's delivering the football. That helps the offensive line out tremendously.
They don't have to hold their blocks as well.
Yeah, they don't have to hold them. They can just go, and that's where it's often been said Peyton Manning is an offensive lineman's best friend because he gets the ball out so quickly. Mm-hmm. And now that he's working in the shotgun and the pistol a little bit more, you're seeing how that's helping him, and hopefully it'll help the offensive line settle down. But they're going to have to find some way to get this running game going. I think it can work in the pistol, and look, when the passing game is working, you can force a defender or two out of the box. You can spread the field a little bit and create some lanes for the running game to work. So I think it's possible that the passing game may be able to help the run blossom. And, you know, it's obviously not the way that Gary Kubiak and Rick Dennison wanted to get there with this ground game. They wanted the run to set up the pass. But maybe in this case, the pass is going to set up the run. And then as the blocking scheme, whether you're talking about the running back or, pardon me, the tight end, the guys, the offensive line, or even a fullback on the rare occasion you use a fullback, they can get some collective confidence. And then as that happens, maybe you can have a scenario later on in the year where the run is effective and does set up the pass at some point. But right now, the Broncos' running game is not yet at a point where an opponent is going to pay it to heavy heed. They're still going to play heavily on the pass and try to defend the Broncos that way.
As we look forward to the Vikings here, I mean, Vaughn said it, Adrian Peterson's their best player, and that's not any kind of knock against anyone on the Vikings, I wouldn't say, but Adrian Peterson had a bit of a rough start in that season opener, as did the entire team, and then he comes back 2 weeks later, and he's the league's leading rusher right mm-hmm. now, third in the league in yards from scrimmage, I believe. He looks a lot like the guy we saw before he went out last year with his legal problems as far as child abuse charges.
Yeah, child abuse charges, and then, of course, a conviction on a lesser charge mm-hmm. associated with that as well. He does look fresh. Again, didn't play much, barely played last year.
One game.
Yeah, one game, and he was out. And so I think that's helped him from a football perspective. Teddy Bridgewater's maturation, I think, has helped him a little bit as well.
They say he looks really poised.
Yeah, and you've got to take him a little bit seriously. Although that being said, listening to Von Miller talk at his press conference Thursday, it's clear that Adrian Peterson is priority number one. And actually, it was interesting. He talked about how you want to force Teddy Bridgewater to throw that if Bridgewater is throwing that or running the ball, that means he's not getting the reads he wants downfield, which is interesting mm-hmm. because Bridgewater has been very dangerous on the ground this year. And looking at the Broncos going back to the preseason, you know, the one kind of consistent bugaboo for their defense was letting mobile quarterbacks get out of contain and make some plays with their legs. Look at what Russell Wilson did in the preseason opener. Look at what Colin Kaepernick did for the 49ers in the third preseason.
I mean, even Alex Smith got some yardage on the ground in that Week 2 game.
So it was interesting to hear Von Miller say that. If Bridgewater runs, then the defense is doing its job. At the same time, you want him to run, but you want to bring him down. You don't want him to bust contain. So right. So Miller and DeMarcus Ware on the edges, and then also Shane Ray and Shaquille Barrett, when they come in, they're going to have to be aware of that threat, and also Brandon Marshall and Dane Trevathan are going to have to be there to clean up, and also T.J. Ward, I think, is going to factor if Bridgewater gets outside of contain, and they're going to be responsible for making sure those intermediate gains don't become long ones.
Well, especially with T.J., I mean, we've spoken about the dime packages that allow them to bring TJ up into the box sometimes, and David Bruton can play back a little bit more. And
it's pretty clear that Wade Phillips loves the flexibility of that
mm-hmm.
too.
That a guy like TJ
is so versatile that it allows him to have Bruton in, because
he's almost like a small linebacker.
Yeah, and I think and Wade, he wants to get his best guys on the field. And you're seeing, and when you see the Broncos in that kind of dime package in terms of personnel, mm-hmm. but in all, it's basically a nickel when you bring T.J. Ward, or sometimes David Bruton comes up as well. You bring one of those guys up. It's basically functioning as a nickel, even though it's your dime guys. That's a good combination of 11 players. Bruton, obviously, he's earned the reps. He's earned the playing time. Did very well in his start in week one. Had the interception in week three. He's really settling into a groove. It's really been fun to see him emerge, because the talk for so long has been always a special teams guy, right. Blah, blah, blah. You know, when you go back, I'll go back to the end of the 2011 season when injuries really shook up the Broncos safety core. Brian Dawkins had the neck injury that ultimately, helped end his career after that year. Raheem Moore saw some time, but he got shaken up. You know, Bruton had to start in the playoffs alongside in the playoff opener alongside Quentin Carter, and he also played against the Patriots in the divisional round. That was a lousy day for the Broncos, but I thought Bruton played very well in the two games in that postseason, and I thought maybe he had earned some more playing time, but didn't work out that way. They brought in Mike Adams the following offseason. Raheem Moore saw more playing time. And Bruton just kind of got a little bit lost in the shuffle. So having watched his career develop for so long, it's really cool to see him emerging and finally doing what, frankly, I think he's been capable of all along, and he just hasn't shown it. He hadn't had the chance to show it until now.
I mean, I can't imagine how happy he must be. He's been known as a special teams kind of guy, and I'm sure that gets kind of tiring at some point.
You always want guys who want to do more, though.
Right.
The ideal, I don't mean this in a bad way. Bruton was kind of the ideal backup because he wanted a bigger role, but he didn't cause a locker room disturbance in politicking for a more expanded role on the team. He focused on what he was tasked with. He led. That's why he's been a special teams captain. And now you're seeing he's getting a chance to enjoy the fruits of his labor, and he's making the most of his shot, of course. That being said, you're having to work him in sub packages because TJ Ward had a phenomenal game Sunday, and Gary Kubiak mentioned Wednesday that Ward was the team's defensive player of the week, and Darian Stewart has played very well. The Broncos have a little bit of an embarrassment of riches at safety right now. They have three guys who are playing at a high starter caliber level, and that's a blessing for them. We'll see what happens going forward because, of course, inevitably there's going to be an injury. And I think at some point Bruton will have a starting assignment or two down the road just because you can't count on your starting safety pair staying healthy for every game all year.
Well, and I think it can be argued that being denoted as a starter is obviously a black and white kind of deal. But with how much they've been using sub packages, he is a starter in a way. He played, I think, almost 40% of the defensive snaps.
Yeah, he's been right at around, if you go for the last two games since TJ Ward came back, kind of dismissed that game in week one when he played a lot because he was the starter then. And he's been right around 50%. Bradley Roby's in that 65% range. Dane Trevathan, as he's continuing to get back up to speed, he's been in the 60% range. So you could say, for all intents and purposes, the Broncos have, 13 starters, 14 starters, the way they're dispersing the reps. And it's been fun to watch this defense because everyone's playing a part. Shaq Barrett mentioned him earlier in the pass rush. He had one of the biggest plays in the win with the strip sack fumble on Matthew Stafford. And just a great play by him to set up the right tackle perfectly and get him out of position.
Yeah.
And then kind of stalk Stafford and flush him out. And Barrett, who's was a weight room demon in the off season, he's strong, but he kept a lot of speed, and he was able to bring down, get Stafford from behind and force the fumble. Just a lot of exciting players on the defensive side of the ball. A lot of talent. I mean, it's early, as Gary Kubiak reminded everybody on Monday, but boy, right now this looks like a special group.
How about Bradley Roby's interception? That was one of the most stunning, just instinctual kind of plays. I mean, if you look at it, he clearly saw Stafford either looking towards that receiver because he left his own guy to go, get in front of, I think it was Golden Tate on that play that he got in front of. Mm-hmm. But he clearly saw something, left the guy in the flat and came over and just...
Amazing read.
Leaping catch.
Yeah, just beautiful. You would have thought he was a wide receiver. Sort of blows
his hands are incredible. So
blows the cliche that guys are on defense because they don't have ball skills. Blows that out of the water.
So during training camp or something, it's usually a group of three DBs, Chris Harris and Akib, and usually it's TJ, but on this day, he was the fourth, Roby was, and they were on the jugs machine catching balls, and they were doing one-handed. And, I mean, like Chris and Akib were kind of trying to, you know, grab it, but it was always kind of trapping it against their body. And Roby goes up on the first time and just catches it with one hand, just like,
think about it.
Yeah, just very natural, very...
Like, I've been doing this all my life. This is easy. Piece of cake.
Just off the machine, though.
Man, he's impressive. Did you see the Pro Football Focus stat?
Yes, he was the top-ranked... I don't know about the one they tweeted out, but he was the top-ranked cornerback from Week 3.
Well...
Or top two or something like that.
I'm looking it up here, but off the top of my head... I believe PFF tweeted out that he had allowed a quarterback rating of 16.7.
That game?
That's
or
it.
Three
no,
games?
All year. And I just found it. Teams targeting Bradley Roby have a passer rating of 16.7.
Wow.
Amazing. What a start he's off to.
To be fair, there are times when I think, you know, Akib got Calvin Johnson all night, and Chris was on zero coverage.
So
obviously he's drawing a bit of different people sometimes. But when he's not, when he's in there, and he's drawing a top receiver, he's been.
And teams don't want to throw it, Akib Talib and Chris Harris Jr.
Now
very often, so
like
throw
a pick
Roby
every game.
Now it's like, okay, we can't throw it, Roby. Who are we going to throw at? You're going to be looking at check downs. Maybe some of a greater onus is going to be placed on Brandon Marshall and Dane Trevathan when they're in coverage as well. So they'll have to step that up that part of their game too.
Peterson has been pretty good in the passing game.
Get him the ball by any means.
Yeah,
doesn't you know? And he'll
kind of like
he'll
a Jamal
make something happen.
Lewis that we see how Kansas City uses
Jamal Charles.
Sorry, my goodness, Jamal Lewis.
We're all tired about him. By the way. Before we started this podcast, we were sharing tales about how exhausted a lot of people in this building are. It's the season. It happens, but we're all kind of we all need to recharge a little bit. I think.
Excuse me, Jamal Charles, a very big weapon for Kansas City's rushing attack, but almost as equally and probably their number one receiving threat, I would say, just because of Alex Smith, the quarterback.
But they got off the Schneid.
Yes, they got their wide receiver going
on the receivers.
Jeremy Maclin got into the end zone.
Yes, hallelujah.
A little too late in that game. They are on a bit of a slide themselves,
and they have the Chiefs have a very very tough game coming up in Cincinnati this week. Mm-hmm. Bengals playing very well, off to a 3-0 start.
Did you see Lawrence Tynes getting mad on Twitter about Alex Smith?
No, what was he saying?
So Lawrence Tynes is a Chiefs fan, and he was saying he's done with Captain Checkdown, he called him, something like that. Ouch. He's like, put in Chase Daniels, I think, as their backup.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was like, put him in. So not exactly
interesting.
A vote of confidence from a former player.
No, I'm surprised and probably... A little bit disappointed in Lawrence Tynes.
Where did
he? Although it's interesting, he's a Chiefs fan. I mean, he also played for Tampa Bay. Although he wouldn't be a fan of the Buccaneers because of the whole MRSA thing. He probably despises the Bucs, and I can't say I blame him for that.
Well, he.
Wouldn't you think Lawrence Tynes would be a big Giants fan, though?
I think it's because the Chiefs were his first team.
I know, but don't. Does it? He's more remembered as a Giant,
right?
I would think because
I think he's probably
go back
still
to their 07 run and he hits in -4 degree chill. He knocks that turned Tom Coughlin's cheeks red. He knocks home the game winning field goal to pull off the upset at Lambeau that sent them to the Super Bowl.
But there's nothing like your first team.
I don't know. That's interesting. I would have said if Lawrence Tynes stuck with one team to be of which he was a fan in retirement, it would have been the Giants. I'm a little surprised that he's a Chiefs
fan. He's probably a little bit of a Giants fan, seeing as how they won Super Bowls. But
yeah, I mean, look, he's got a ring on his finger.
Two.
Two. Oh, that's right. He was still there in 2011. He's got two rings on his finger because he was a New York Giant.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Well. Unless, I don't know about his personal situation, maybe he married a Kansas City girl.
I don't know.
I don't know, but who Lawrence Tynes married?
That's possible.
Anyway, I digress.
So do you want to, since you were the one who spotted this, do you want to be the one to bring up the the connection between Peyton Manning and the Vikings? I'm sure there's many, but
there is a big familial connection. Mm-hmm. You obviously remember whether you saw it yourself or you're aware of it, that Archie Manning is a longtime New Orleans Saint.
Yeah.
That's jersey retired. I would still say, with all respect to Drew Brees, that Archie Manning is the most beloved New Orleans Saint ever.
Mm-hmm.
Again, also, all due respect to Ricky Jackson as well and Willie Rofe and a few others. Archie Manning had a little bit of a whistle-stop journey at the end of his career. He got traded to Houston.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then eventually ended up in Minnesota.
Crossing the Mason-Dixon line.
Exactly. And I know this happened because I remember the game in 1984, and it's actually on YouTube. Archie Manning is starting for the Vikings at Soldier Field against the Bears, the big, bad monsters of the Midway. This is, you know, we know about what their defense was in 1985, so in 84 it was rounding into form. The Bears sacked Archie Manning 11 times that day.
That's
at Soldier Field.
Not the NFL record.
No.
Somehow.
But still it's a lot. I mean,
almost.
For Peyton Manning, that's like half a season.
Mm-hmm. Last year it was
more than half a season.
Yeah, I don't know how many last year he got.
Yeah, Archie Manning was briefly a Minnesota Viking. He backed up Tommy Kramer. His last career start for the Vikings was actually in a game at San Francisco later on that year. The other interesting thing, there's in the Vikings game notes that I have here in front of me, there's a picture of Archie Manning as a Viking, and it's a game, it looks like it's against the Atlanta Falcons, and he's wearing jersey number 4. So if you look at Archie Manning, you do a double take and think, is that Brett Favre?
I did. I took a double take.
The only reason I didn't do a double take was he had a white face mask.
Oh.
Although, if I'm not mistaken, in a black and white picture, it can kind of look similar. Brett Favre did play a few games as a Viking with a gray face mask when they wore their throwback uniforms, because of course, the Vikings can wear throwbacks and have them be accurate because they've always had purple helmets. So all they have to do is take off one set of face masks, put on the other, put on new uniforms. So mm-hmm. Unlike the Broncos and the Patriots and the Bucks, who all have really amazing throwbacks if they could wear them but can't right now, you know, the Vikings can wear a throwback. But yeah, Archie Manning as a Viking, it's one of those things that you're almost like, did that really happen? Like Jerry Rice as a Seahawk. And a Bronco. Of course, he didn't play for the Broncos in the regular season, but he did play for the Seahawks
mm-hmm.
in the regular season back in 2004. Joe Namath as a Ram
there's,
in 1977.
There's a lot. I mean,
this is kind of an obscure one, but James Brooks, a longtime running back for the Bengals, I remember him closing his career fumbling for the Buccaneers. Another former Viking, Joey Browner, he was a great safety back in the 1980s. He briefly played for Tampa Bay at the end of his career. Didn't look right at all.
It's like Jordan in a
Washington Wizards.
Yeah. Or Patrick Ewing in a, I think he was a
Orlando Magic.
Was it the Magic? I think he also played for the Sonics. That was weird. That was really weird.
Or did he coach the Magic?
Coach the Magic. He was an assistant coach for the Magic. Anyway, it's always weird when they go to other teams and the jerseys are like especially if you go from a team that like the Knicks or something, or or the 49ers, who have really classic jerseys and they don't change very much, and then you go to like a really modernized like brand style like the Seahawks or the Sonics or or whoever at the time has a really weird jersey, and they're just like, this is too weird.
Yeah, Jerry Rice is a Bronco. I mean, the Broncos. Yeah. Obviously, it's a 1990s designed uniform, but in 2005, it's still pretty modern, and certainly compared to what he wore in San Francisco and even Oakland.
Yeah,
it was a jarring sight to see that big orange stripe going up the side, and also let alone the fact that he had to wear number 19 because number 80 belonged to Rod Smith.
That is a rare case where someone would not give like a jersey number.
Well, at the same, could you blame Rod Smith? He'd been there for over a decade, and he.
I'm not blaming anyone. It's just like probably in most places anywhere else, Jerry Rice would have gone. Mm-hmm. He probably would have gotten that number.
But they couldn't do it. If it had been a guy who'd been around a couple of years, sure. But
right. At
that point, Rod Smith had done more than enough in service to the organization that. You weren't going to ask him to take away number 80,
right?
That would have been foolish and short sighted. But yeah, Ty Law was a Bronco in 2009. That came up because he was a finalist he's on the preliminary list of nominees for the Hall of Fame this year, and
you have to list all the teams.
Yeah, and I saw and I was like, oh yeah, don't forget to at least mention Ty Law.
Yeah.
We're not talking about a guy like John Lynch who actually played four really good years
here,
although age kind of caught up to him late, but he was very well. And John Lynch is going to be joining us this week. He's calling the game.
Oh, yeah.
That was not in the initial plans, I believe, but Fox kind of shook things up, so it's going to be Kevin Burkhart and John Lynch and the esteemed Pam Oliver on the sidelines.
It's good.
Good crew.
You introduced me to him, I guess it was in the preseason. God, it seems so long now.
Oh, John Lynch?
Yeah. Great guy.
He's one of the best people that's come through here and really represented the Broncos well and the Buccaneers well for so long. When he came to Denver the first time back in 2004, I was a little bit starstruck. Because for those of you who don't know, I spent a few years in Tampa when I was growing up, had Buccaneer season tickets. And I remember I was in high school watching John Lynch play. And I was a Bucs fan, and thus I was a John Lynch fan. And I was beyond excited when the Broncos got him. And, beyond, and I had to kind of overcome kind of that fan thing a little bit.
Yeah.
But I did, and I got to know him, and just a real, real, real quality person, great locker room leader, got along with everybody. I kind of thought of him as a little bit of a Ferris Bueller type, not in terms of being the impish prankster, but just, you remember when Grace, Ed Rooney's secretary, is talking about, all the cliques in school, how they all love Ferris, they think he's a righteous dude. That's sort of the way John Lynch was. He crossed all barriers in that locker room. Everyone really thought the world of him.
Yeah,
that's tough. That's really tough for a guy to do. I think that's one reason why he's been such a good broadcaster, because he's still very relatable. And you can see when he comes out here for to watch a practice, to watch a camp practice, because of course he calls Broncos preseason games as well. You can see how well he relates to the players that he's covering right now. He's covering right now, even though he's been removed from the game as a player for 7 years. And it's always good to have him back. Hopefully, maybe we can get a little bit lucky and get him on the air. We'll see.
And I guess the last thing, because I'm working on a story about this, I wanted to talk about is DeMarcus Ware's first conference Defensive Player of the Month award, which is stunning. Multiple time all first team All Pro. His accolades go on and on. And so I'm looking back at his best months, and I got in contact with one of the NFL's historians for the NFC, because back then, obviously, NFC player, for who got the award that month instead. And so I've isolated his entire 2008 season, December of 2006, September of 2011, October of 2011, and September of 2013.
Okay.
If we start at the earliest, 2006 was Brian Dawkins, and I can't put any... I can't say anything bad about him getting this award because he had 32 total tackles, one sack, two interceptions, two forced fumbles, and the Eagles won all their games.
En route to a division title,
mm-hmm.
I believe.
He was a first-team All-Pro that year.
Yes.
One of those interceptions led to a game-winning field goal. So
a great player at the apex of his powers.
In that span, Ware had 28 total tackles, 5.5 sacks, an interception, return for a touchdown against the Falcons. Mike Vick, I guess, thought he had something in the flat, under pressure.
And he's Mike Vick now, by the way.
Mike Vick, yeah.
I mean, now I
not Michael Vick.
He's yeah, he has told the Steelers he wants to be formally referred to as Mike Vick.
The artist formerly known as Michael Vick.
Well, given everything that happened, I can't blame him for wanting to get away from a little relic of his past.
Yeah. But at the time, the Cowboys were not great. I think they ended up with like a 7-9 record that year.
In
06?
Or is it 08?
06.
06, they went to the playoffs. That was the Tony Romo drop the snap game in Seattle.
Well, they had a 2-3 record in that five games of December. So not great.
The end of Bill Parcells' coaching career was that season.
He didn't get that year. 2008, if we start with September, Charles Woodson, three interceptions, nine passes defense, two touchdowns.
Yeah,
two interceptions returned for touchdowns. 2-2 record, so, you know, the record doesn't...
So in both cases, you're talking about two guys who almost certainly will be in the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Like I expect DeMarcus Ware to be. So he's a little bit of bad luck that they had career months at the same time as DeMarcus Ware.
This was Ware's 20-sack season.
Yeah.
He had five sacks during that month, a pass deflection, 23 tackles.
Okay. So, what's the next month?
Next month is John Beeson. He had 32 total tackles, two interceptions, two passes defense, which are those interceptions, I would think. Panthers had a 3-1 record. They had a shutout in that span, and Beeson was an All-Pro and went to the Pro Bowl that season.
That would be October of 2008.
Yes.
The shutout was against Kansas City.
Yes.
That
2-14
was a
season.
Dadgum dominant defense, and no offense to DeMarcus Ware, but I saw John Beeson play that month. And Beeson's going to, because of the injuries he would later eventually suffer,
mm-hmm.
he's always going to be a little bit of a what if.
Yeah.
Because before he started getting banged up, he was as good a middle linebacker as you'll ever see.
If we move on to the next month, another Panther, Julius Peppers, in November, seven sacks. Seven sacks.
How many did DeMarcus have in that month?
Six.
So they probably just said, okay. No offense, DeMarcus, but Julius got seven. You had six.
Julius also had three forced fumbles. They had a 3-1 record.
So despite what the Twitter commenter said, we got the Panthers in this podcast.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I've been trying. But sometimes history just rules against whatever you're trying against. DeMarcus had one forced fumble. They did have a 3-1 record during that span, so unfortunately.
The other thing you mentioned is that the Panthers had 3-1 records in those spans, and of course we all know how John Fox always aimed to go 3-1 every quarter.
Well, I think they ended up pretty close to that, but
they actually, in both the 08 and seasons in Carolina and the 2014 season in Denver, he did get that 3-1 every quarter. And unfortunately for both teams, the playoff result was the same.
I'm biting my tongue. And then,
hey, why not shoot for 4-0?
Yeah, shoot for.
I'm just saying, you know.
Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head.
Don't stop. Don't stop at the stratosphere. Try to get to the moon.
Yeah, there's that saying that's on every elementary school wall. Shoot for the stars and you'll land on the moon or something.
It's
shoot for the moon, land on the
stars. Shoot for the moon. If you don't make it, you'll land among the stars. But I would say shoot for the stars because the stars are much farther away. And then if you don't make
it,
you might
right?
still get past the moon.
Yeah, anyway. And then finishing off that season, Woodson coming back again. Two interceptions, four passes defensed, one sack, A 1-3 record, though.
Yeah, but what's... I mean, look. I covered a game that year, Panthers at Packers.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
Steve Smith
game.
Against Charles Woodson. I mean, two Titans in a one-on-one battle. I've never...
Smitty won it, though.
Yes, Steve Smith did win it. And if someday I'm ever privileged to be in the Hall of Fame selection room, I will get on the table and bang it for Steve Smith. And that game is actually going to be one game that's a piece of evidence because Charles Woodson.
Great ending to that
game. Charles Woodson is going to be about a 3-minute discussion when he goes into the Hall of Fame.
I mean, it this past week and he had the ceiling interception against the Browns.
I know. He's still got it. It's amazing. He's defying time. And Father Time's still unbeaten, but Woodson's putting up a hell of a fight. Let me say that again because you're going to Hunt's going to be like, hell of a fight. Charles Woodson's defying Father Time, but he's putting up a heck of a fight. But I look back at that game, those two guys at their apexes, and Steve Smith got the better of Charles Woodson.
Peppers had a great game in that one, too. Yeah. That was the month that he was player of the month, and he had a couple sacks, I think, on Rodgers and ended up...
But there's another instance where DeMarcus Ware had a player of the month caliber month and got beat out, right?
I would say the Sean Lee one is kind of throwing me off.
Beaten by a teammate.
By the way, that Charles Woodson, that December of 2008, Ware had 5 sacks, 4 forced fumbles, and the Cowboys had a 1-3 record, so a little bit of a mark.
So the record was a push between Woodson and Ware's teams.
5 sacks, 4 forced fumbles, that's pretty nasty. Moving on, Sean Lee, 28 tackles, 3 tackles for a loss, 2 interceptions, 3 passes defense, 2 fumble recoveries, and one of those interceptions was nearly returned for a touchdown. It was reviewed, and he was down at the 1.
And what did DeMarcus do that month?
DeMarcus had 5 sacks. But you have to think, does he set up some of those interceptions?
I would think so.
Knowing what we know about the interceptions here so far
this year and how the pass rush is setting them up, I would say DeMarcus was a root cause of it, of
Sean Lee's Defensive Player of the Month award. No offense, Sean
This
Lee,
just appears
listening.
To be a galactic oversight, honestly.
Just incredible. A combination of a little bit of oversight and a lot of spectacular play by some Hall of Famers. Or
someone like John Beeson just having a career month.
Yeah. And then the final two here, Jared Allen, just incredible. Jared Allen had 8 sacks in October of 2011, 2 forced fumbles, 2 fumble recoveries, 2 passes defensed, 62 total yards lost on those sacks.
Since he was a Viking then.
Yeah, incredible season. Defensive player of the year that year. You can't knock that, right? That's just wild. I think he had 22 and a half sacks that season. So, Jared Allen, you get that one. September of 2013, this is the last one. Richard Sherman, 2 interceptions, 4 passes defensed, 4-0 record for the Seahawks on that Super Bowl season. And one of those interceptions went for a touchdown with two minutes 40 seconds left in the game, tied the game. Seahawks ended up winning in overtime. So.
And then what did Ware do that month?
I haven't gotten around to it. So.
Well, but the other thing I'm thinking about without knowing the stats.
September of 2011.
That's 2013?
Yeah, September 2013.
That was a horrible Cowboy defense.
Yeah.
In October, of course, if you recall, the Broncos marched up and down the field at will. Of course, the Cowboys did the same thing in that 51-48 shootout in Arlington that the Broncos ultimately won on Danny Trevathan's just leaping, diving interception when the game was tied at 48. How fun was that? That I look back at that game and say the game was tied at 48. That's another game. I'll never see anything like that again in person.
Over under of 96 push.
It was like watching arena football
or a college football game. If you're with who was it? Who like TCU and
Texas Tech? 55-52.
Barn burner.
College football is out of hand now.
That's a college basketball score.
Yeah. Actually, there will be some games played in the Big Ten this year that have lower total points, several games, than TCU and Texas Tech did. I mean, college football is fun, but boy, I think it's getting out of hand. They got to
run up
some,
the scores, huh?
Yeah, it's you get the perception now that like 30, 35 points is just an average day at the office.
Yeah.
Unless you watch Mizzou. Mizzou has no offense and now a suspended quarterback.
Wait, he got suspended?
Yeah, Mighty Mock violated team rules.
Oh, no. Oh, no. They lost to, was it Kentucky?
I could see that coming a mile away. If you saw
Kentucky
watching the Arkansas State and UConn games, I knew they were screwed.
Watching the Arkansas State game, yeah, like everyone did, right? We all watched that one.
Hey, that's how I spend my Saturday nights.
Oh.
Watching the Mizzou-Arkansas State game.
Hey, I mean.
It's nothing but a party at the Mason House.
Jeez. Going back to that 2013, you know, that's – I was just kind of looking for ones where he had at least four sacks in four games or something like that. And he had four sacks, four games. The issue was he had four sacks in two games. And so his first game and his fourth game had zero. But the first one did have an interception. So I figured that was at least in the contention there.
Oh, absolutely.
But not quite a game-sealing or game-tying interception return.
Amazing, though, that not a player that great.
He revolutionized that position. DeMarcus with the outside linebacker position at that
time.
Well,
I wouldn't say he revolutionized it. Lawrence Taylor revolutionized it.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
DeMarcus Ware simply is another very strong link in that chain. You know, you think about Taylor and Andre Tippett in the 80s, and you think about guys like Derek Thomas in the, you know, was the Mandarin of that position in the 1990s when the Chiefs won the 3-4. And DeMarcus Ware, to me, kind of is one of the guys that defines the 2000s.
Yeah.
And now the 2010s at that position. And now that Von Miller is playing outside linebacker in a 3-4, I think he's the next one in line. You know.
DeMarcus coming up, I think Lawrence Taylor is the next guy on the all-time sacks list for him. So very, very
DeMarcus
quickly following
is
those
at the
footsteps.
DeMarcus Ware is at the point now where if he retired tomorrow, I think his case for Canton would be secure.
Mm-hmm. I loved his quote on Thursday, by the way. 1982 bottle of wine, breaking it open, and let me bring it up real quick. I just feel like I opened that 1982 bottle of wine, and I'm drinking it right now. It's pretty expensive, so it tastes good. And then he said it's a Bordeaux.
I like the fact that he's got a little bit of high culture taste to him.
Oh yeah,
but
he
the
is
thing
a
is
one of a kind person.
If you see DeMarcus Ware, not when he's like just dressed like, you know, in a t-shirt, but sometimes like when he'll get dressed before a press gathering, very well put together guy, very fashionable. Like,
he could
model.
He's styling and profiling. I was just saying he is.
He looks great. Like he looks great in men's fashion. And I say that with a staunch record of heterosexuality.
He is, you know, I was telling Chris Hall today that he is just one of a kind of professional athlete. He's very down to earth, very approachable. He has he's very interested in different kinds of arts. I mean, we were talking about in the locker room, I was talking about his photography, and he went out to Garden of the Gods out in Colorado here and took some photos, and that's what he does on his off days. He goes out and explores Colorado, and there aren't guys who just I'm going to go exploring Colorado. I mean, just playing in professional football.
If I was asked which of the players was most likely to go visit a museum on an art day, on an off day, I would say it'd be DeMarcus Ware.
I would agree.
There's a lot going on with him. Very, very bright guy. Very, very worldly.
Yes.
Person.
He is a guy who, I mean, if you just follow him on Instagram, on Twitter, or, you know, whatever social media channel you want to, you follow him around the country, around the world. He went to Panama during their time off before camp. You know, just going to Panama with your family, That's the life, right?
what I could do if I had that kind of money.
Well,
I'd be a world traveler too.
As we just went over his career accolades, I mean, he's earned that money for sure.
Yes.
What a talent.
And you get the feeling that he can do whatever he wants in retirement. If he mm-hmm. wants to go into broadcasting, he can do that. If he wants to go coach, he could do that, although I don't think he wants the hours.
I could see him just leaving professional football behind and like the entire everything around it. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'd probably come for some things, you know, like, mm-hmm. hey, we're getting, you know, the team back together or whatever. We're, you know.
Well, he'll always be in legend in Dallas. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's only, you know, been here. He's only in his second season. So, you know, I'm not sure he's going to have all the accolades that he here that he will in Dallas. But it depends how long he stays, you know.
It depends what kind of success the team has True. With him as well.
Win a Super Bowl. And
you'll be remembered. Whether you
but everyone's going to remember him as a
year or not.
Yeah, but everyone's going to remember him as a Cowboy. And you know what? That's okay. People are going to remember Peyton Manning more as a Colt than a Bronco. That's okay, too. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But we got to see some of their greatness here, and that's cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I'm certainly in awe, regardless of what stage of their career.
And enjoy these moments, because the roster doesn't always have players like this.
Yeah.
I've seen it.
Looking forward, coming up, we have the Vikings on our docket on Sunday at 2:25 Mountain Time. Got to be 2:25 exact. So get to your seats early or TV, because if you're at 2:30, you'll be late. So don't do that.
And the way the Broncos defense has been playing, if it gets on the field first and you tune in 5 minutes late, you might miss a sack, an interception, fumble, forced fumble.
Who knows? Because
they've been starting out very well.
Thanks for tuning in. You can subscribe on iTunes. Get a little caught on my words there. And we'll catch y'all in a week's time as we get ready to head to Oakland. Exciting.